wisdom. Byrne was a good man in his way, but the wound he had taken at the Bridge of Skulls had hardened his attitudes, and the only song he ever sang now was his familiar refrain about sealing the gates. Athel Yarwick was as stolid and unimaginative as he was taciturn, and the first rangers seemed to die as quick as they were named. "The Night's Watch has lost too many of its best men," John reflected, as the wagons began to move. "The Old Bear, Corran Halfhand, Donal Noy, Jarman Buckwell, my uncle." A light snow began to fall as the column made its way south along the King's Road, the long line of wagons wending past fields and streams and wooded hillsides, with a dozen spearmen and a dozen archers riding escort. The last few trips had seen some ugliness at Molestown, a little pushing and shoving, some muttered curses, a lot of sullen looks. Byrne Marsh felt it best not to take chances, and for once he and John were agreed. The Lord Steward led the way. John rode a few yards back, Dolorous Ed Tullett at his side. Half a mile south of Castle Black, Ed urged his garron close to John's and said, "My lord, look up there, the big drunkard on the hill." The drunkard was an ash tree, twisted sideways by centuries of wind. And now it had a face, a solemn mouth, a broken branch for a nose, two eyes carved deep into the trunk, gazing north up the King's Road toward the castle and the wall. The wildlings brought their guards with them, after all. John was not surprised. Men do not give up their guards so easily. The whole pageant that Lady Melisandre had orchestrated beyond the wall suddenly seemed as empty as a mummer's farce. "Looks a bit like you, Ed," he said, trying to make light of it.
"Aye, my lord, I don't have leaves growing out of my nose, but elsewise, Lady Melisandre won't be happy."
"She's not like to see it. See that no one tells her."
"She sees things in those fires, though."
"Smoke and cinders."
"And people burning. Me, most like, with leaves up my nose. I always feared I'd burn, but I was hoping to die first."
John glanced back at the face, wondering who had carved it. He had posted guards around Molestown, both to keep his crows away from the wildling women and to keep the free folk from slipping off southward to raid. Whoever had carved up the ash had eluded his sentries plainly, and if one man could slip through the cordon, others could as well. "I could double the guard again," he thought sourly, "waste twice as many men, men who might otherwise be walking the wall." The wagons continued on their slow way south, through frozen mud and blowing snow. A mile farther on, they came upon a second face, carved into a chestnut tree that grew beside an icy stream, where its eyes could watch the old plank bridge that spanned its flow.
"Twice as much trouble," announced Dolorous Ed.
The chestnut was leafless and skeletal, but its bare brown limbs were not empty. On a low branch overhanging the stream, a raven sat, hunched, its feathers ruffled up against the cold. When it spied John, it spread its wings and gave a scream. When he raised his fists and whistled, the big black bird came flapping down, crying, "Corn! Corn! Corn!" "Corn for the free folk," John told him. "None for you." He wondered if they would all be reduced to eating ravens before the coming winter had run its course. The brothers on the wagons had seen this face as well, John did not doubt. No one spoke of it, but the message was plain to read for any man with eyes. John had once heard Mansueda say that most kneelers were sheep. "Now a dog can herd a flock of sheep," the king beyond the wall had said, "but free folk, well, some are shadow cats and some are stones. One kind prowls where they please and will tear your dogs to pieces. The other will not move at all unless you kick them." Neither shadow cats nor stones were like to give up the gods they had worshipped all their lives to bow down before one they hardly knew. just north of Molestown, they came upon the third watcher, carved into the huge oak that marked the village perimeter, its deep eyes fixed upon the King's Road. "That is not a friendly face," John Snow reflected. The faces that the first men and the children of the forest had carved into the weirwoods in eons past had stern or savage visages more oft than not. But the great oak looked especially angry, as if it were about to tear its roots from the earth and come roaring after them. Its wounds are as fresh as the wounds of the men who carved it. Molestown had always been larger than it seemed. Most of it was underground, sheltered from the cold and snow. That was more true than ever now. The Magna of Thin had put the empty village to the torch when he passed through on his way to attack Castle Black, and only heaps of blackened beams and old scorched stones remained above ground. But down beneath the frozen earth, the vaults and tunnels and deep cellars still endured, and that was where the free folk had taken refuge, huddled together in the dark like the moles from which the village took its name. The wagons drew up in a crescent, in front of what had once been the village smithy. Nearby, a swarm of red-faced children were building a snow fort, but they scattered at the sight of the black-cloth brothers, vanishing down one hole or another. A few moments later, the adults began to emerge from the earth. A stench came with them, the smell of unwashed bodies and soiled clothing, of night soil and urine. John saw one of his men wrinkle his nose and say something to the man beside him. Some jape about the smell of freedom, he guessed. Too many of his brothers were making japes about the stench of the savages in Molestown. Pig ignorance, John thought. The free folk were no different than the men of the Night's Watch. Some were clean, some dirty, but most were clean at times and dirty at other times. This stink was just the smell of 1,000 people jammed into cellars and tunnels that had been dug to shelter no more than 100. The wildlings had done this dance before. Wordless, they formed up in lines behind the wagons. There were 3 women for every man, many with children, pale, skinny things clutching at their skirts. John saw very few babes in arms. The babes in arms died during the march, he realized, and those who survived the battle died in the king's stockade. The fighters had fared better. 300 men of fighting age, Justin Massey had claimed in council. Lord Harwood Fell had counted them. There will be spear wives, too, 50, 60, maybe as many as 100. Fell's count had included men who had suffered wounds, John knew. He saw a score of those. Men on crude crutches, men with empty sleeves and missing hands, men with one eye or half a face, a legless man carried between 2 friends, and everyone grey-faced and gaunt. Broken men, he thought. The whites are not the only sort of living dead. Not all the fighting men were broken, though. Half a dozen Thens in bronze-scale armour stood clustered round one cellar stair, watching sullenly and making no attempt to join the others. In the ruins of the old village smithy, John spied a big, bald slab of a man he recognized as Halleck, the brother of Harmer, Dog's Head. Harmer's pigs were gone, though. Eaten, no doubt. Those 2 in furs were horn-foot men, as savage as they were scrawny, barefoot even in the snow. There are wolves amongst these sheep still. Val had reminded him of that on his last visit with her.
Free folk and kneelers are more alike than not, John Snow. Men are men and women women, no matter which side of the wall we were born on. Good men and bad, heroes and villains, men of honour, liars, cravens, brutes. We have plenty, as do you.
She was not wrong. The trick was telling one from the other, parting the sheep from the goats. The Black Brothers began to pass out food. They'd brought slabs of hard salt beef, dried cod, dried beans, turnips, carrots, sacks of barley meal and wheaten flour, pickled eggs, barrels of onions and apples. "You can have an onion or an apple," John heard Hairy Hal tell one woman, "but not both. You gotta pick." The woman did not seem to understand.
"I need two of each. One of each for me, t'other's for my boy. He's sick, but an apple will set him right."
Hal shook his head. "He has to come get his own apple. Or onion, not both. Same as you. Now, is it an apple or an onion? Be quick about it now. There's more behind you."
"An apple," she said, and he gave her one, an old dried thing, small and withered.
"Move along, woman," shouted a man three places back. "It's cold out here."
The woman paid the shout no mind.
"Another apple," she said to Hairy Hal, "for my son, please. This one is so little."
Hal looked to John. John shook his head. They would be out of apples soon enough. If they started giving two to everyone who wanted to, the latecomers would get none.
"Out of the way," a girl behind the woman said.
Then she shoved her in the back. The woman staggered, lost her apple, and fell. The other foodstuffs in her arms went flying. Beans scattered. A turnip rolled into a mud puddle. A sack of flour split and spilled its precious contents in the snow. Angry voices rose in the old tongue and the common. More shoving broke out at another wagon.
"It's not enough," an old man snarled. "You bloody crows are starving us to death."
The woman who'd been knocked down was scrabbling on her knees after her food. John saw the flash of naked steel a few yards away. His own bowmen knocked arrows to their strings. He turned in his saddle. "Rory, quiet them." Rory lifted his great horn to his lips and blew, "Oh!" The tumult and the shoving died. Heads turned. A child began to cry. Mormon's raven walked from John's left shoulder to his right, bobbing its head and muttering,
"Snow! Snow! Snow!"
John waited until the last echoes had faded, then spurred his palfrey forward, where everyone could see him. "We're feeding you as best we can, as much as we can spare. Apples, onions, neeps, carrots. There's a long winter ahead for all of us, and our stores are not inexhaustible."
"You crows eat good enough," Halleck shoved forward.
"For now, we hold the wall. The wall protects the realm and you, now. You know the foe we face? You know what's coming down on us? Some of you have faced them before, whites and white walkers. Dead things with blue eyes and black hands. I've seen them too, fought them, sent a few to hell. They kill, then they send your dead against you. The giants were not able to stand against them, nor you Thens, the Ice River clans, the Hornfoots, the Free Folk, and as the days grow shorter and the nights colder, they are growing stronger. You left your homes and came south in your hundreds and your thousands. Why? But to escape them, to be safe. Well, it's the wall that keeps you safe. It's us that keeps you safe, the black crows you despise."
"Safe and starved,"
said a squat woman with a wind-burned face, a spear-wife by the look of her. "You want more food?" asked John. "The food's for fighters. Help us hold the wall, and you'll eat as well as any crow." Or as poorly, when the food runs short. A silence fell. The wildlings exchanged wary looks.
"Eat!"
the raven muttered.
"Corn! Corn! Fight for you!"
This voice was thickly accented. Sigorn, the young Magna of Thenn, spoke the common tongue haltingly as best.
"Not fight for you! Kill you better! Kill all you!"
The raven flapped its wings.
"Kill! Kill!"
Sigorn's father, the old Magna, had been crushed beneath the falling stair during his attack on Castle Black. "I would feel the same if someone asked me to make common cause with the Lannisters," John told himself. "Your father tried to kill us all, he reminded Sigurd. The Magna was a brave man, yet he failed. And if he had succeeded, who would hold the wall? He turned away from the Thens. Winterfell's walls were strong as well, but Winterfell stands in ruins today, burned and broken. A wall is only as good as the men defending it. An old man with a turnip cradled against his chest said,
"You kill us, you starve us, and now you want to make us slaves."
A chunky red-faced man shouted assent.
"I'd sooner go naked than wear one of them black rags on my back."
One of the spear-wives laughed.
"Even your wife don't want to see you naked, Butts."
A dozen voices all began to speak at once. The Thens were shouting in the old tongue. A little boy began to cry. Jon Snow waited until all of it had died down, then turned to Hairy Hal and said, "Hal, what was it that you told this woman?" Hal looked confused.
About the food, you mean? An apple or an onion, that's all I said. They got to pick.
You have to pick, Jon Snow repeated. All of you. No one is asking you to take our vows, and I do not care what gods you worship. My own gods are the old gods, the gods of the north. But you can keep the Red God or the Seven or any other god who hears your prayers. It's spears we need, bows, eyes along the wall. I will take any boy above the age of 12 who knows how to hold a spear or string a bow. I will take your old men, your wounded, and your cripples, even those who can no longer fight. There are other tasks they may be able to perform, fletching arrows, milking goats, gathering firewood, mucking out our stables. The work is endless. And yes, I will take your women too. I have no need of blushing maidens looking to be protected, but I will take as many spear wives as will come.
And girls?
A girl asked. She looked as young as Arya had the last time John had seen her.
16 and older.
You're taking boys as young as 12.
Down in the Seven Kingdoms, boys of 12 were often pages or squires. Many had been training at arms for years. Girls of 12 were children. These are wildlings, though. As you will. Boys and girls as young as 12, but only those who know how to obey an order. That goes for all of you. I will never ask you to kneel to me, but I will set captains over you and sergeants who will tell you when to rise and when to sleep, where to eat, when to drink, what to wear, when to draw your swords and loose your arrows. The men of the Night's Watch serve for life. I will not ask that of you, but so long as you are on the wall, you will be under my command. Disobey an order, and I'll have your head off. Ask my brothers if I won't. They've seen me do it.
Off!
Screamed the old bear's raven. Off, off, off! The choice is yours, Jon Snow told them. Those who want to help us hold the wall, return to Castle Black with me, and I'll see you armed and fed. The rest of you, get your turnips and your onions, and crawl back inside your holes. The girl was the first to come forward.
I can fight. My mother was a spear wife.
John nodded. She may not even be 12, he thought, as she squirmed between a pair of old men. But he was not about to turn away his only recruit. A pair of striplings followed her, boys no older than 14. Next, a scarred man with a missing eye.
I've seen them too, the dead ones. Even crows are better than that.
A tall spearwife, an old man on crutches, a moon-faced boy with a withered arm, a young man whose red hair reminded John of Ygritte. And then Halleck.
I don't like you, Crow, he growled, but I never liked the manse neither, no more than my sister did. Still, we fought for him. Why not fight for you?
The dam broke then. Halleck was a man of note. Manse was not wrong. Free folk don't follow names or little cloth animals sewn on a tunic, the king beyond the wall had told him. They won't dance for coins. They don't care how you style yourself, or what that chain of office means, or who your grandsire was. They follow strength. They follow the man. Halleck's cousins followed Halleck, then one of Harmer's banner-bearers, then men who'd fought with her, then others who had heard tales of their prowess, greybeards and green boys, fighting men in their prime, wounded men and cripples, a good score of spear-wives, even three horn-footmen. But no Thins. The Magna turned and vanished back into the tunnels, and his bronze-clad minions followed hard at his heels. By the time the last withered apple had been handed out, the wagons were crowded with wildlings, and they were 63 stronger than when the column had set out from Castle Black that morning. "What will you do with them?" Bowen Marsh asked John on the ride back up the King's Road. "Train them, arm them, and split them up. Send them where they're needed. East Watch, the Shadow Tower, Icemark, Grey Guard. I mean to open three more forts as well." The Lord Steward glanced back.
"Women, too? Our brothers are not accustomed to having women amongst them, my lord. Their vows. There will be fights, rapes."
"These women have knives and know how to use them.
And the first time one of these spear-wives slits the throat of one of our brothers, what then?"
"We will have lost a man," said John. "But we have just gained 63. Now, you're good at counting, my lord. Correct me if I'm wrong, but my reckoning leaves us 62 ahead." Marsh was unconvinced.
"You have added 63 more mouths, my lord. But how many are fighters? And whose side will they fight on?" "If it's the others at the gates, most like they'll stand with us, I grant you. But if it's Tormund Giantsbane or the Weeping Man come calling with 10,000 howling killers, what then?"
"Then we'll know. So let us hope it never comes to that."
The Queen Maker. Beneath the burning sun of dawn, wealth was measured as much in water as in gold, so every well was zealously guarded. The well at Shandystone had gone dry 100 years before, however, and its guardians had departed for some wetter place, abandoning their modest holdfast with its fluted columns and triple arches. Afterward, the sands had crept back in to reclaim their own. Ariane Martel arrived with Drey and Silver just as the sun was going down, with the west a tapestry of gold and purple, and the clouds all glowing crimson. The ruins seemed aglow as well. The fallen columns glimmered pinkly. Red shadows crept across the cracked stone floors, and the sands themselves turned from gold to orange to purple as the light faded. Garin had arrived a few hours earlier, and the knight called Darkstar the day before. "It is lovely here," Drey observed as he was helping Garin water the horses. They had carried their own water with them. The sand steeds of Dawn were swift and tireless and would keep going for long leagues after other horses had given out, but even such as they could not run dry. "How did you know of this place?" "My uncle brought me here with Tyene and Sirella." The memory made Ariane smile. "He caught some vipers and showed Tyene the safest way to milk them for their venom. Sirella turned over rocks, brushed sand off the mosaics, and wanted to know everything there was to know about the people who had lived here." "And what did you do, princess?" asked Spotted Silver. "I sat beside the well and pretended that some robber knight had brought me here to have his way with me," she thought, "a tall, hard man with black eyes and a widow's peak." The memory made her uneasy. "I dreamed," she said, "and when the sun went down I sat cross-legged at my uncle's feet and begged him for a story." Prince Oberyn was full of stories. Garin had been with them as well that day. He was Ariane's milk brother, and they had been inseparable since before they learned to walk. He told me about Prince Garin, I remember, the one that I was named for. "Garin the Great," offered Drey, "the wonder of the Roin. That's the one. He made Valyria tremble." "They trembled," said Sir Geralt. "Then they killed him. If I led a quarter of a million men to death, would they call me Geralt the Great? He snorted. I shall remain Darkstar, I think. At least it is mine own. He unsheathed his longsword, sat upon the lip of the dry well, and began to hone the blade with an oilstone. Arianne watched him warily. He is high-born enough to make a worthy consort, she thought. Father would question my good sense, but our children would be as beautiful as dragon lords. If there was a handsomer man in Dorne, she did not know him. Sir Geralt Dane had an aquiline nose, high cheekbones, a strong jaw. He kept his face clean-shaven, but his thick hair fell to his collar like a silver glacier, divided by a streak of midnight black. He has a cruel mouth, though, and a crueler tongue. His eyes seemed black as he sat outlined against the dying sun, sharpening his steel, but she had looked at them from a closer vantage, and she knew that they were purple, dark and angry. He must have felt her gaze upon him, for he looked up from his sword, met her eyes, and smiled. Arianne felt heat rushing to her face. I should never have brought him. If he gives me such a look when Arys is here, we will have blood on the sand. Whose, she could not say. By tradition, the Kingsguard were the finest knights in all the Seven Kingdoms, but Darkstar was Darkstar. The Dornish knights grow cold out upon the sands. Garin gathered wood for them, bleached white branches from trees that had withered up and died 100 years ago. Dre built a fire, whistling, as he struck sparks off his flint. Once the kindling caught, they sat around the flames and passed a skin of summer wine from hand to hand, all but Darkstar, who preferred to drink unsweetened lemon water. Garin was in a lively mood and entertained them with the latest tales from the Planky Town at the mouth of the Greenblood, where the orphans of the river came to trade with the carracks, cogs, and galleys from across the narrow sea. If the sailors could be believed, the East was seething with wonders and terrors. A slave revolt in Astapor, dragons in Carth, grey plague in Yi Ti. A new corsair king had risen in the Basilisk Isles and raided Tall Trees Town, and in Kohor, followers of the Red Priests had rioted and tried to burn down the Black Goat, and the Golden Company broke its contract with Myr, just as the Myr men were about to go to war with Lys. The Lysini bought them off, suggested Silver. Clever Lysini, Dre said. Clever craven Lysini. Arianne knew better. If Quentin has the Golden Company behind him. Beneath the gold, the bitter steel, was their cry. You will need bitter steel and more, brother, if you think to set me aside. Arianne was loved in Dorne, Quentin little known. No company of sellswords could change that. Sir Geralt rose. I believe I'll have a piss. Watch where you set your feet, Dre cautioned. It has been a while since Prince Oberyn milked the local vipers. I was weaned on venom, dolt. Any viper takes a bite of me will rue it. Sir Geralt vanished through a broken arch. When he was gone, the others exchanged glances. Forgive me, princess, said Garin softly, but I do not like that man. A pity, Dre said. I believe he's half in love with you. We need him, Arianne reminded them. It may be that we will need his sword, and we will surely need his castle. High Hermitage is not the only castle in Dorne, Spotted Silver pointed out, and you have other knights who love you well. Dre is a knight. I am, he affirmed. I have a wonderful horse and a very fine sword, and my valor is second to, well, several, actually. More like several hundred, sir, said Garin. Arianne left them to their banter. Dre and Spotted Silver were her dearest friends, aside from her cousin Tyene, and Garin had been teasing her since both of them were drinking from his mother's teats, but just now she was in no mood for japery. The sun was gone and the sky was full of stars. So many. She leaned her back against a fluted pillar and wondered if her brother was looking at the same stars tonight, wherever he might be. Do you see the white one, Quentin? That is Nymeria's star, burning bright, and that milky band behind her, those are 10,000 ships. She burned as bright as any man, and so shall I. You will not rob me of my birthright. Quentin had been very young when he was sent to Irrenwood, too young, according to their mother. Novoshi did not foster out their children, and Lady Melario had never forgiven Prince Doran for taking her son away from her. "I like it no more than you do," Ariane had overheard her father say, "but there is a blood debt, and Quentin is the only coin Lord Ormond will accept." "Coin!" her mother had screamed. "He is your son! What sort of father uses his own flesh and blood to pay his debts?" "The princely sort," Doran Martell had answered. Prince Doran was still pretending that her brother was with Lord Ironwood, but Garin's mother had seen him at the Planky Town, posing as a merchant. One of his companions had a lazy eye, the same as Cletus Ironwood, Lord Anders's randy son. A maester travelled with them too, a maester skilled in tongues. "My brother is not as clever as he thinks. A clever man would have left from Old Town, even if it meant a long voyage. In Old Town, he might have gone unrecognized." Ariane had friends amongst the orphans of the Planky Town, and some had grown curious as to why a prince and a lord's son might be travelling under false names and seeking passage across the narrow sea. One of them had crept through a window of a night, tickled the lock on Quentin's little strongbox, and found the scrolls within. Ariane would have given much and more to know that this secret trip across the narrow sea was Quentin's own doing and his alone, but parchments he had carried had been sealed with the sun and spear of Dawn. Garin's cousin had not dared break the seal to read them, but... "Princess," Sir Gerald Dane stood behind her, half in starlight and half in shadows. "How was your piss?" Ariane inquired archly. The Sands were duly grateful. Dane put a foot upon the head of a statue that might have been the maiden till the sands had scoured her face away. "It occurred to me as I was pissing that this plan of yours may not yield you what you want." "And what is it I want, sir?" "The sand snakes freed, vengeance for Oberyn and Elia. Do I know the song? You want a little taste of lion blood." "That and my birthright. I want Sunspear and my father's seat. I want Dawn. I want justice. Call it what you will. Crowning the Lannister girl is a hollow gesture. She will never sit the Iron Throne, nor will you get the war you want. The lion is not so easily provoked. The lion's dead. Who knows which cub the lioness prefers? The one in her own den." Sir Geralt drew his sword. It glimmered in the starlight, sharp as lies. "This is how you start a war, not with a crown of gold, but with a blade of steel. I am no murderer of children. Put that away. Missella is under my protection, and Sir Aris will permit no harm to come to his precious princess. You know that." "No, my lady. What I know is the Danes have been killing Oakhearts for several thousand years." His arrogance took her breath away. "It seems to me that Oakhearts have been killing Danes for just as long. We all have our family traditions." Darkstar sheathed his sword. "The moon is rising, and I see your paragon approaching." His eyes were sharp. The horseman on the tall grey palfrey did indeed prove to be Sir Aris, white cloak fluttering bravely as he spurred across the sand. Princess Myrcella rode pillion behind him, swaddled in a cowled robe that hid her golden curls. As Sir Aris helped her from the saddle, Dre went to one knee before her. "Your Grace." "My Lady Liege," Spotted Silver knelt beside him. "My Queen, I am your man." Garin dropped to both knees. Confused, Myrcella clutched Aris Oakheart by the arm. "Why do they call me Grace?" she asked in a plaintive voice. "Sir Aris, what is this place and who are they?" "Has he told her naught?" Ariane moved forward in a swirl of silk, smiling to put the child at ease. "They are my true and loyal friends, Your Grace, and would be your friends as well." "Princess Ariane!" The girl threw her arms around her. "Why do they call me Queen? Did something bad happen to Tommen?" "He fell in with evil men, Your Grace," Ariane said, "and I fear they have conspired with him to steal your throne." "My throne? You mean the Iron Throne?" The girl was more confused than ever. "He never stole that. Tommen is younger than you, surely." "I am older by a year." "That means the Iron Throne by rights is yours," Ariane said. Your brother is only a little boy. You must not blame him. He has bad counsellors, but you have friends. May I have the honour of presenting them? She took the child by the hand. Your Grace, I give you Sir André Dalt, the heir to Lemonwood. My friends call me Dre, he said, and I should be greatly honoured if Your Grace would do the same. Though Dre had an open face and an easy smile, Myssela regarded him warily. Until I know you, I must call you Sir. Whatever name Your Grace prefers, I am her man. Silva cleared her throat, till Ariane said, Might I present Lady Silva Santagar, my queen? My dearest spotted Silva. Why do they call you that? Myssela asked. For my freckles, Your Grace, Silva answered, though they all pretend it is because I am heir to Spotswood. Garin was next, a loose-limbed, swarthy, long-nosed fellow with a jade stud in one ear. Here is gay Garin of the Orphans, who makes me laugh, said Ariane. His mother was my wet nurse. I am sorry she is dead, Myssela said. She's not, sweet queen. Garin flashed the golden tooth Ariane had bought him to replace the one she'd broken. I'm of the Orphans of the Green Blood, is what my lady means. Myssela would have time enough to learn the history of the Orphans on her voyage up the river. Ariane led her queen-to-be to the final member of her little band. Last, but first in valour, I give you Sir Geralt Dane, a knight of Starfall. Sir Geralt went to one knee. The moonlight shone in his dark eyes as he studied the child coolly. There was an Arthur Dane, Myssela said. He was a knight of the Kingsguard in the days of Mad King Ares. He was the Sword of the Morning. He is dead. Are you the Sword of the Morning now? No. Men call me Darkstar, and I am of the night. Ariane drew the child away. You must be hungry. We have dates and cheese and olives and lemon sweet to drink. You ought not eat or drink too much, though. After a little rest, we must ride. Out here on the sands, it is always best to travel by night before the sun ascends the sky. It is kinder to the horses. And the riders, Spotted Silver said. Come, Your Grace, warm yourself. I should be honored if you'd let me serve you. As she led the princess to the fire, Ariane found Sir Geralt behind her. My house goes back 10,000 years unto the dawn of days, he complained. Why is it that my cousin is the only Dane that anyone remembers? He was a great knight, Sir Aris Oakheart put in. He had a great sword, Darkstar said, and a great heart. Sir Aris took Ariane by the arm. Princess, I beg a moment's word. Come. She led Sir Aris deeper into the ruins. Beneath his cloak, the knight wore a cloth of gold doublet embroidered with the three green oak leaves of his house. On his head was a light steel helm topped by a jagged spike, wound about with a yellow scarf in the Dornish fashion. He might have passed for any knight but for the cloak. Of shimmering white silk it was, pale as moonlight and airy as a breeze. A Kingsguard cloak, beyond all doubt, the gallant fool. How much does the child know? Little enough. Before we left King's Landing, her uncle reminded her that I was her protector, and that any commands that I might give her were meant to keep her safe. She has heard them in the streets as well, shouting out for vengeance. She knew this was no game. The girl is brave and wise beyond her years. She did all I asked of her and never asked a question. The knight took her arm, glanced about, lowered his voice. There are other tidings you should hear. Tywin Lannister is dead. That was a shock. Dead, murdered by the imp. The queen has assumed the regency. Has she? A woman on the Iron Throne? Ariane thought about that for a moment and decided it was all to the good. If the lords of the Seven Kingdoms grew accustomed to Queen Circe's rule, it would be that much easier for them to bend their knees to Queen Myssela. And Lord Tywin had been a dangerous foe. Without him, Dorne's enemies would be much weaker. Lannisters are killing Lannisters. How sweet! What became of the dwarf? He's fled, Sir Aris said. Circe is offering a lordship to whosoever delivers her his head. In a tiled inner courtyard, half buried by the drifting sands, he pushed her back against a column to kiss her, and his hand went to her breast. He kissed her long and hard, and would have pushed her skirts up, but Ariane broke free of him, laughing. "I see that queen-making excites you, sir, but we have no time for this. Later, I promise you." She touched his cheek. "Did you meet with any problems?" "Only Tristan. He wanted to sit beside Marcella's bedside and play Saivas with her." "He had red spots when he was 4, I told you. You can only get it once. You should have put out that Marcella was suffering from grayscale. That would have kept him well away. The boy, perhaps, but not your father's maester." "Caliot," she said. "Did he try to see her?" "Not once I described the red spots on her face. He said that nothing could be done until the disease had run its course, and gave me a pot of salve to soothe her itching. No one under 10 ever died of red spots, but it could be mortal in adults, and Master Caliot had never suffered it as a child. Ariane learned that when she suffered her own spots at 8.
"Good," she said.
"And the handmaid? Is she convincing?"
"From a distance. The imp picked her for this purpose over many girls of nobler birth. Marcella helped her curl her hair and painted the dots on her face herself. They are distant kin. Lannisport teams with Lannies, Lannets, Lantels, and lesser Lannisters, and half of them have that yellow hair. Dressed in Marcella's bedrobe, with the maester's salve smeared across her face, she might even have fooled me in a dim light. It was a deal harder to find a man to take my place. Dake is closest to my height, but he's too fat. So I put Rolder in my armor and told him to keep his visor down. The man is 3 inches shorter than I am, but perhaps no one will notice if I'm not there to stand beside him. He'll keep to Marcella's chambers in any case. All we need is a few days. By that time the princess will be beyond my father's reach."
"Where?" He drew her close and nuzzled at her neck. "It's time you told me the rest of the plan, don't you think?" She laughed, pushing him away. "No, it's time we rode." The moon had crowned the Moon Maid as they set out from the dust-dry ruins of Shandystone, striking south and west. Ariane and Sir Aris took the lead with Marcella on a frisky mare between them. Garin followed close behind with Spotted Silver, whilst her 2 Dornish knights took the rear. "We are 7, Ariane realized as they rode. She had not thought of that before, but it seemed a good omen for their cause. 7 riders on their way to glory. One day the singers will make all of us immortal. Dre had wanted a larger party, but that might have attracted unwelcome attention, and every additional man doubled the risk of betrayal. That much my father taught me, at the least. Even when he was younger and stronger, Doran Martell had been a cautious man, much given to silences and secrets. It is time he put his burdens down, but I will suffer no slights to his honor or his person. She would return him to his water gardens to live out what years remained him surrounded by laughing children and the smell of limes and oranges. Yes, and Quentin can keep him company. Once I crown Marcella and free the sand snakes, all Dawn will rally to my banners. The Irrenwoods might declare for Quentin, but alone they were no threat. If they went over to Tommen and the Lannisters, she would have Darkstar destroy them root and branch.
I am tired, Marcella complained after several hours in the saddle. Is it much farther? Where are we going?
Princess Ariane is taking your grace to a place where you'll be safe, Sir Aris assured her.
It's a long journey, Ariane said, but it will go easier once we reach the Greenblood. Some of Garin's people will meet us there, the orphans of the river. They live on boats and pole them up and down the Greenblood and its vassals, fishing and picking fruit and doing whatever work needs doing.
Aye, Garin called out cheerfully, and we sing and play and dance on water and know much and more of healing. My mother is the best midwife in Westeros, and my father can cure warts.
How can you be orphans if you have mothers and fathers? The girl asked.
They are the Rhoynar, Ariane explained, and their mother was the River Rhoyne. Marcella did not understand.
I thought you were the Rhoynar. You Dornishmen, I mean.
We are in part, Your Grace.
Nymeria's blood is in me, along with that of Mors Martell, the Dornish lord she married. On the day they wed, Nymeria fired her ships so her people would understand that there could be no going back. Most were glad to see those flames, for their voyagings had been long and terrible before they came to Dorne, and many and more had been lost to storm, disease, and slavery. There were a few who mourned, however. They did not love this dry red land or its seven-faced god, so they clung to their old ways, hammered boats together from the hulks of the burned ships, and became the orphans of the green blood. The mother in their songs is not our mother, but Mother Ruin, whose waters nourish them from the dawn of days. I'd heard the Ruinar had some turtle god, said Solaris. The old man of the river is a lesser god, said Garin. He was born from Mother River too, and fought the Crab King to win dominion over all who dwell beneath the flowing waters.
Oh, said Myrcella.
I understand you've fought some mighty battles too, your grace, said Drey in his most cheerful voice. It is said you show our brave Prince Tristan no mercy at the Syvas table.
He always sets his squares up the same way, with all the mountains in the front and his elephants in the passes, said Myrcella. So I send my dragon through to eat his elephants.
Does your handmaid play the game as well? Asked Drey.
Rosamond, asked Myrcella.
No.
I tried to teach her, but she said the rules were too hard. She is a Lannister as well, said Lady Silver.
A Lannister of Lannisport, not a Lannister of Casterly Rock. Her hair is the same colour as mine, but straight instead of curly. Rosamond doesn't truly favour me, but when she dresses up in my clothes, people who don't know us think she's me.
You have done this before, then?
Oh, yes. We traded places on the Sea Swift on the way to Braavos. Septa Eglantine put brown dye in my hair. She said we were doing it as a game, but it was meant to keep me safe in case the ship was taken by my uncle Stannis. The girl was plainly growing tired, so Arianne called a halt. They watered the horses once again, rested for a bit, and had some cheese and fruit. Myrcella split an orange with spotted silver, whilst Garin ate olives and spit the stones at Drey. Arianne had hoped to reach the river before the sun came up, but they had started much later than she'd planned, so they were still in the saddle when the eastern sky turned red. Darkstar cantered up beside her.
Princess, he said, I'd set a faster pace unless you mean to kill the child after all. We have no tents, and by day the sands are cruel.
I know the sands as well as you do, sir, she told him. All the same, she did as he suggested. It was hard on their mounts, but better she should lose six horses than one princess. Soon enough the wind came gusting from the west, hot and dry and full of grit. Arianne drew her veil across her face. It was made of shimmering silk, pale green above and yellow below, the colours blending into one another. Small green pearls gave it weight and rattled softly against each other as she rode.
I know why my princess wears a veil, Sir Aris said, as she was fastening it to the temples of her copper helm. Elsewise her beauty would outshine the sun above. She had to laugh.
No, your princess wears a veil to keep the glare out of her eyes and the sand out of her mouth. You should do the same, sir. She wondered how long her white knight had been polishing his ponderous gallantry. Sir Aris was pleasant company abed, but wit and he were strangers. Her Dornishmen covered their faces as she did, and spotted silver helped veil the little princess from the sun. But Sir Aris stayed stubborn. Before long the sweat was running down his face, and his cheeks had taken on a rosy blush. Much longer, and he will cook in those heavy clothes, she reflected. He would not be the first. In centuries past many a host had come down from the prince's pass with banners streaming, only to wither and broil on the hot red Dornish sands. The arms of House Martell display the sun and spear, the Dornishman's two favoured weapons, the young dragon had once written in his boastful conquest of Dorn, but of the two, the sun is the more deadly. Thankfully, they did not need to cross the deep sands, but only a sliver of the dry lands. When Arianne spied a hawk wheeling high above them against a cloudless sky, she knew the worst was behind them. Soon they came upon a tree.
It was a gnarled and twisted thing with as many thorns as leaves, of the sort called sand beggars, but it meant that they were not far from water. "We're almost there, Your Grace," Garin told Marcella cheerfully, when they spied more sand beggars up ahead, a thicket of them growing all around the dry bed of a stream. The sun was beating down like a fiery hammer, but it did not matter with their journey at its end. They stopped to water the horses again, drank deep from their skins and wet their veils, then mounted for the last push. Within half a league they were riding over devil grass and past olive groves. Beyond a line of stony hills the grass grew greener and more lush, and there were lemon orchards watered by a spider's web of old canals. Garin was the first to spy the river glimmering green. He gave a shout and raced ahead. Ariane Martel had crossed the Mander once, when she had gone with three of the sand snakes to visit Tyene's mother. Compared to that mighty waterway, the green blood was scarce worthy of the name of river, yet it remained the life of Dawn. It took its name from the murky green of its sluggish waters, but as they approached, the sunlight seemed to turn those waters gold. She had seldom seen a sweeter sight. The next part should be slow and simple, she thought, up the green blood and onto the Vaith as far as a pole boat can go. That would give her time enough to prepare Marcella for all that was to come. Beyond Vaith, the deep sands waited. They would need help from Sandstone and the Hellholt to make that crossing, but she did not doubt that it would be forthcoming. The Red Viper had been fostered at Sandstone, and Prince Oberyn's paramour Elaria Sand was Lord Ulla's natural daughter. Four of the Sand Snakes were his granddaughters. I will crown Marcella at the Hellholt and raise my banners there. They found the boat, half a league downstream, hidden beneath the drooping branches of a great green willow. Low of roof and wide abeam, the pole boats had hardly any draft to speak of. The young dragon had disparaged them as hovels built on rafts, but that was hardly fair. All but the poorest orphan boats were wonderfully carved and painted. This one was done in shades of green with a curved wooden tiller shaped like a mermaid, and fish faces peering through her rails. Poles and ropes and jars of olive oil cluttered her decks, and iron lanterns swung fore and aft. Ariane saw no orphans. Where is her crew? She wondered. Garin reined up beneath the willow. "Wake up, you fish-eyed lagabeds!" he called as he leapt down from the saddle. "Your queen is here and wants her royal welcome. Come up, come out! We'll have some songs and sweet wine. My mouth is set for—" The door on the pole boat slammed open. Out into the sunlight stepped Ario Hota, long axe in hand. Garin jerked to a halt. Ariane felt as though an axe had caught her in the belly. It was not supposed to end this way. This was not supposed to happen. When she heard Dre say, "There's the last face I'd hoped to see," she knew she had to act. "Away!" she cried, vaulting back into the saddle. "Aris, protect the princess!" Hotar thumped the butt of his long axe upon the deck. Behind the ornate rails of the pole boat, a dozen guardsmen rose, armed with throwing spears or crossbows. Still more appeared atop the cabin. "Yield, my princess," the captain called, "else we must slay all but the child and yourself by your father's word." Princess Myrcella sat motionless upon her mount. Garin backed slowly from the pole boat, his hands in the air. Dre unbuckled his sword belt. "Yielding seems the wisest course," he called to Ariane as his sword thumped to the ground. "Now!" Sir Aris Oakheart put his horse between Ariane and the crossbow, his blade shining silver in his hand. He had unslung his shield and slipped his left arm through the straps. "You will not take her whilst I still draw breath." "You reckless fool," was all that Ariane had time to think. "What do you think you're doing?" Darkstar's laughter rang out. "Are you blind or stupid, Oakheart? There are too many. Put up your sword." "Do as he says, Sir Aris," Dre urged. "We are taken, sir," Ariane might have called out, "Your death will not free us. If you love your princess, yield." But when she tried to speak, the words caught in her throat. Sir Aris Oakheart gave one last longing look, then put his golden spurs into his horse and charged. He rode headlong for the pole boat, his white cloak streaming behind him. Ariane Martel had never seen anything half so gallant or half so stupid. "No!" she shrieked, but she had found her tongue too late. A crossbow thrummed, then another. Hotar bellowed a command. At such close range, the White Knight's armor had as well been made of parchment. The first bolt punched right through his heavy oaken shield, pinning it to his shoulder. The second grazed his temple. A thrown spear took Sir Aris's mount in the flank, yet still the horse came on, staggering as he hit the gangplank. "No!" some girl was shouting, some foolish little girl. "No, please, this was not supposed to happen!" She could hear Myrcella shrieking too, her voice shrill with fear. Sir Aris's longsword slashed right and left, and two spearmen went down. His horse reared and kicked a crossbowman in the face as he tried to reload. But the other crossbows were firing, feathering the big courser with their quarrels. The bolts hit home so hard, they knocked the horse sideways. His legs went out from under him and sent him crashing down the deck. Somehow Aris Oakheart leapt free. He even managed to keep hold of his sword. He struggled to his knees beside his dying horse and found Ario Hotar standing over him. The White Knight raised his blade too slowly. Hotar's long axe took his right arm off at the shoulder, spun away spraying blood, and came flashing back again in a terrible two-handed slash that removed the head of Aris Oakheart and sent it spinning through the air. It landed amongst the reeds, and the green blood swallowed the red with a soft splash. Ariane did not remember climbing from her horse. Perhaps she'd fallen. She did not remember that either. Yet she found herself on her hands and feet in the sand, shaking and sobbing and retching up her supper. "No," was all that she could think. "No, no one was to be hurt. It was all planned. I was so careful." She heard Ario Hotar roar, "After him! He must not escape! After him!" Myrcella was on the ground, wailing, shaking, her pale face in her hands, blood streaming through her fingers. Ariane did not understand. Men were scrambling onto horses whilst others swarmed over her and her companions, but none of it made sense. She had fallen into a dream, some terrible red nightmare. "This cannot be real. I will wake soon and laugh at my night terrors." When they sought to bind her hands behind her back, she did not resist. One of the guardsmen jerked her to her feet. He wore her father's colors. Another bent and seized the throwing knife inside her boot, a gift from her cousin, Lady Nim. Ario Hotar took it from the man and frowned at it. "The prince said I must bring you back to Sunspear," he announced. His cheeks and brow were freckled with the blood of Aris Oakheart. "I am sorry, little princess." Ariane raised a tear-streaked face. "How could he know?" she asked the captain. "I was so careful. How could he know?"
"Someone told," Hotar shrugged. "Someone always tells."
Tyrion. "Are you certain you must leave us so soon?" the Lord Commander asked him. "Past certain, Lord Mormont," Tyrion replied. "My brother Jaime will be wondering what has become of me. He may decide that you have convinced me to take the black." "Oh, would that I could." Mormont picked up a crab claw and cracked it in his fist. Old as he was, the Lord Commander still had the strength of a bear. "You're a cunning man, Tyrion. We have need of men of your sort on the wall." Tyrion grinned. "Then I shall scour the Seven Kingdoms for dwarfs and ship them all to you, Lord Mormont." As they laughed, he sucked the meat from a crab leg and reached for another. The crabs had arrived from Eastwatch only this morning, packed in a barrel of snow, and they were succulent. Sir Alistair Thorne was the only man at table who did not so much as crack a smile. "Lannister mocks us." "Only you, Sir Alistair," Tyrion said. This time the laughter around the table had a nervous, uncertain quality to it.
Thorn's black eyes fixed on Tyrion with loathing. "You have a bold tongue for someone who is less than half a man. Perhaps you and I should visit the yard together." "Why?" asked Tyrion. "The crabs are here." The remark brought more.